Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.
We're happy to be joined by the voice of the San Francisco Giants, one of the greatest broadcasting voices of all time. And when he and Joe Morgan were working together, that Sunday night booth is where my baseball education truly began. And it's the greatest national booth of my lifetime. It's beloved more than many a local booth. They were magic together, and we're so happy to welcome here to Damon Ratto and Kolsky, the big kahuna himself, John Miller. John, thank you so much for joining us. Let's start with a condolences for the passing of your friend Joe Morgan.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And it is a very sad day. And I think for anybody who knew him well, still sort of a day of disbelief, because somehow you thought that he was somebody who would go on much longer, and because he had so much energy. Joe not only was somebody who had a lot of drive, but he just had sort of an inexhaustible supply of energy, and he was always doing not just the job, either as a player or later as a broadcaster, but had other business interests that he took care of, and raised money for charity, and went around helping others raise money for charity. And he was always, whenever I saw him, he was always coming in from some function or some business, some other place. And so that's the Joe Morgan that I remember, and always somebody who was on the move. And so I'm kind of still in a state of disbelief that he's gone.
John, do you remember the first time the two of you met, or has that been lost in the ether?
Well, I think the first time, at least that I remember actually meeting Joe, was when he was in his final season as a player, 1984, with the Oakland Athletics, and he came to the American League, and I did an interview with him. I was doing the Baltimore Oriole games, and I found him during batting practice and asked him if he would do an interview with me, and he was happy to do it. And I found him to be in not just a good interview, but engaging and very thoughtful. So, and I think that's why the broadcasting thing fit in for Joe so well, because he was somebody who had not just the great knowledge of the game, but he was somebody who had a great passion for the game, and he wanted to tell you the things that he knew about the game. He had a lot to say about the game too. So I guess that was not just the first time that I met him, but the first time that I got exposed to who he really was.
That said, when it was broached to you that he would be your partner, did you think he would study? Did you think you were going to have to work with him? And what was the most surprising thing as a broadcaster that he brought that maybe you didn't think players normally bring?
Well, I knew that he had the knowledge of the game, and he really was always focused on the game, and I think that when we did a game for him, it was always about what was in the player's head. What was he trying to do in this situation? What would be his thinking as to what kind of a pitch he was looking to hit, or what the pitcher might be doing to try to get him out? And it wasn't about his statistics or all of those different things. In fact, I had a talk today with Corey Bush, because Corey, a former Giants executive, and a great baseball fan, but Corey was not only the guy who put together Mike Grutko and Dwayne Kuiper as a broadcast entity for the Giants, but before that, when Joe Morgan had finished as a player, he helped Joe Morgan become a broadcaster with the Giants, and Joe was paired with Dwayne Kuiper. And the first time I remember hearing Joe on a Giants telecast, Joe and I were already working together on ESPN Sunday Night Baseball, and I was surprised. Joe was the play-by-play guy, and it was a no-hitter that Terry Mulholland was pitching for the Phillies against the Giants, and Joe was the guy doing the play-by-play with Kipe as his analyst, and Joe had never mentioned that he did play-by-play. I asked Corey Bush about that, and he said that he asked Joe if he would be comfortable doing play-by-play. And told him to think about it, because Joe had told him that he'd never even thought about it. And he said, well, think about it and let me know what you think, because he felt that if Joe was going to do something, that he wanted to be really good at it, as good as he possibly could be, that he would not undertake something if he thought, no, that's I would not be good at that. So he just wanted to see what Joe thought, because then he felt whichever way Joe went with it, that he was sure he would be successful with it. So that was an interesting insight into, I think, how Joe's thinking went. And I think, you know, we started the Sunday Night Baseball together as two guys from different worlds. You know, he was a great Hall of Fame player. He went into the Hall of Fame that year, the first year we did Sunday Night Baseball together, 1990, was inducted in that summer. And you know, I was a guy who was a baseball fan, not a great player. Not even as a little leaguer was I a great player. But so we were two different people from two different baseball worlds, but at the same time, the one thing we had in common was that we loved the game, and every Sunday night when we were paired together, the ballpark was the place we most wanted to be in the world. So and I think that passion for the game and affection for being around the game never left Joe. Even when we did those games for 21 years, and that was pretty impressive to me, because you know, a lot of things can happen in a lifetime in all those years, but for Joe that just never changed, and I think that was the thing that we loved about each other.
Like Damon said, John, you and Joe were really the soundtrack to baseball every summer for me for most of my life, for my formative years certainly. I do not, however, remember him at all as a player. So for those of us too young to remember, what set him apart as a second baseman? What makes him one of the best of all time?
You know, it's interesting. When Joe and I were hooked up in 1990 as a team, I remember we were in a car, and I don't know if we were heading to a game or from a game or whatever, and I told him that Bill James, you know, the stats guru, the godfather of the modern baseball statistics, had a book out at that time called The Historical Baseball Abstract, which looked at the history of the game, and one of the things it tried to do was create a formula where he could evaluate players from different eras and compare and contrast them from one era to the next. And it wasn't his opinions of players, but rather the results of his formulas that he was talking about in the book. And he concluded that Joe Morgan, for many different reasons, may have been the best second baseman of all time at his peak. And so I remember telling that to Joe, and which was a pretty big compliment. And Joe argued with me and argued with Bill James and said, well, Rogers Hornsby hit 420 and hit 42 home runs one season. Nobody was better than that. And I said, well, you know, I went through it trying to talk about how James had done his evaluation. But I think Joe knew, no matter how great a hitter's ballpark you played in, no matter what era you were in, if you hit 420 and you hit 42 home runs, that was extraordinary, and he could appreciate just how great that was. But Joe, all round, could do everything. He could hit for average. He had power. He was one of the great base stealers in history, and he was a Gold Glover. He won those two consecutive MVP championships or MVP awards back in the mid 70s with all of that putting together. When Joe Morgan was on base, he was always a threat to run, but only if the team really needed it. You know, he was never padding his stolen base total when his team had a big lead. But at the same time, his knowledge of the game was so complete. Sparky Anderson many times said and told me he never had signs for Joe because he says Joe doesn't need him. Joe knows if we need a steal, and he'll just go ahead and do it. Or if a hit and run is just the right thing for that moment, he'll put a hit and run on. And so that's just the confidence that Sparky Anderson had in Joe's knowledge of the game, a guy who didn't need any kind of signs. And so that's who Joe was, and is an exciting a player. And I think a lot of people, when he was at his peak, with the big red machine in the 70s, thought that he was cocky. And Joe said, well, you know, if you're a base stealer, you have to be cocky. If you're a guy who's going to steal a base in a tight game in the eighth inning or later, say a tie game or your team's down by a run, you need a steal, and everybody in the park knows you're going to try to steal the base, and you do it, you have to be cocky because they're trying to do everything in their power to keep you from doing that. But Joe, at his peak, you know, he would steal 68 bases, 70 bases, and only get thrown out 7, 8, 9 times a season in that regard. And some of those were pickoffs and maybe balk moves and whatnot that the pitcher got away with. So he just was a truly great player, and he never claimed that accolade for himself, as I learned, but he did say in the 70s that he said, if you're talking about maybe all-round, the best all-round player who could do a little bit of everything to beat you, then maybe that's true. But he would never say that he was the best player. He thought there are plenty of guys who had more talent, more ability than him to do different things in the game. But he did also allow us how nobody maybe had the all-round ability to do what he could do. So he truly was something to see. And I think that at that time, if you look at the teams he was with, they got better. You know, Chris Haft pointed out today, the longtime reporter and Giants beat writer, that, you know, the Giants had not had a winning season for a while, and they had not had two consecutive winning seasons for years. And Joe got there, and it was near the end of Joe's career, 1981-82. And they had winning years both seasons, and in 82 they were a contender right until the final days of the season. So Joe was a guy who truly made a difference.
Radio mechanics say reintroduce the guest as if this voice needed any reintroduction. Of course, John Miller joining us here on 95.7 The Game. Was it your goal with Joe to create so much of a baseball education? Because Joe Morgan taught me as much about baseball, attitudes, mechanics, pitch counts, how it changed the game. It was almost as if he was doing play pre-play. It wasn't by play. He would tell you what would happen before it happened, John.
Well, you know, I do remember there was a game early on in Sunday Night Baseball, maybe 1991 or somewhere in there, 1990, at Yankee Stadium. And the Yankees were not a good team. But Don Mattingly was their best guy. He was their biggest star. And they were down by 2 runs in the last of the ninth inning. And it was a game at Yankee Stadium, even on a Sunday night, nationally televised game. The paid crowd was, you know, maybe 28,000. The stadium was half full. And so I said, well, is this a spot where you think Mattingly, who's got power, is going to be up there trying to hit a 2-run homer to tie this ball game because that's what his team needs with 2 down in the ninth inning? And Joe said, well, I don't think he's going to think he's trying to hit a home run. I think it's a situation where, because if you try to hit a home run, that's when you go completely out of your game and you make mistakes with your approach and you end up, you know, popping a ball up or turning over on a ball, grounding it out, because you're trying to get open too soon to pull the ball. And so if he gets a pitch that's pullable, then I think he'll go ahead and do it. Well, soon enough, Mattingly got one to pull, and he planted a 2-run homer in right field. And you know, they, and he said after the game, says, well, I wasn't per se trying to hit a home run, but I thought that maybe I could do it in a controlled way so that if I got the right pitch, that I was definitely going to try to turn on it and pull it and hit it into that short porch out there in right field at Yankee Stadium. So Mattingly himself basically repeated the words that Joe had put out there before the fact in that game, just as you're talking about. So the one fun thing I remember that always jumps out for me was a game at Yankee Stadium on Memorial Day, and they were playing the Oakland Athletics on a Monday afternoon, and there were a couple of men on. Joe Torre had come to the team as manager that year, so it must have been 96. And it was said that Joe Torre had brought a National League style of ball to the Yankees, that they looked to run and force the action and did a lot of hitting and running and base stealing, things like that. And they weren't just always sitting around waiting to hit the long ball to score runs. So they got a couple of guys on, and I started talking with Joe about, well, do you think these guys both have speed that they're going to put a hit and run on here? The guy at the plate's got good back control and whatnot. And Joe said, well, I can see the stage is set maybe for a hit and run play that could open a hole, but I don't think he's going to do it. So I just kept bringing that up, the whole at bat. It ended up being a long at bat, like 9 or 10 pitch at bat. And I kept saying, well, what about now? I don't understand why they're just sitting. I mean, this is what he's brought to the team. Why are they not doing something here? Because this guy's also a double play threat. And finally, Joe said, well, I'm with you on this. Certainly, you could see this being a good play. But a lot of managers do not want to put a hit and run on here with nobody out because you've got a rally in the making. And if a guy hits a line drive right at somebody, that's a triple play, and the whole inning's over. The whole thing collapses just like that. So I wasn't willing to let the subject drop. And I said, well, isn't that the least likely thing that could happen, that the guy, just at the moment the runners are going, he hits a line drive right at somebody? And he says, yeah, that's it is. But I'm just trying to tell you, for most managers, that is why they would not do it, and probably why Joe Torre hasn't sent them even yet. So finally, the count got to 3-2, and I said, well, what about now? It's 3-2. Don't you think they've got to be going now? And he said, well, I think that they will be going now, but even now, I think a lot of managers would not send those runners for the reasons I've already brought up. So the runners took off, line drive up the middle. Randy Velarde was playing second for the A's that day, a former Yankee, and he had broken to cover second base with the runners going, and he caught the ball right behind second, went over and tagged the bag for the second out and threw the first triple play. Is that why they won't do it? And
there it is.
And Joe had, you know, he had laid it all out and got into the mind of a manager's way of thinking. So that was a particular case where the players just went ahead and then played it out for us to show us why managers think that way.
Again, John, condolences on the loss of an incredibly beautiful partnership between two Hall of Famers. You ended up there yourself one day. And the passing of your friend. We thank you very much for sharing some of your memories with us today. It meant a lot for you to join us, and we want to wish you a great off season and enjoy, and we so look forward to you being a part of the soundtrack of our lives. So thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate it, and I will say, I mean, it not only is a sad day, but for me, Joe Morgan not only was a great ball player, but a Hall of Famer, and he's been honored for that. But he was a pioneer in the broadcast booth as well. He was an African-American on national television baseball telecasts in prime time, and a trailblazer in that regard as well. And I think that, you know, Frank Robinson was the first African-American manager in Major League Baseball, and Joe, he was not the first African-American broadcaster, but the first on national television, especially on a primetime baseball telecast. And in that way, I think, and he lasted 21 years doing that, 21 seasons, which kind of says it all about how well-received he was and how good he was at it. And it's truly a big loss in the baseball community, that's for sure. Thank you.
Indeed it is. Thank you so much, John. The Big Kahuna, John Miller, here on 95.7 The Game. It's like when he just goes, you just let him go. It's like Trey's taking a solo. Just everyone lay back here and just let it happen. And
story time with John. It's one of my favorite things.
It's the best. Again, there aren't a lot of broadcasts that improve when there's a rain delay. But that's when Japanese Vin Scully comes out. That's when all the stories. And, you know, we talk about what incredibly smart and how much recall that Joe Morgan had. The recall on John Miller and the details of the memories are just, it's unbelievable. That's why they are among the greatest to do what they do in the entire history of Major League Baseball. And that's saying something.
Yes, Damon. I remember a Thursday in 1991, we were driving in the car. It's like, oh, wow. I don't remember last Thursday.
Exactly. What I have for breakfast, I'm not even sure. But let me tell you, that day they opened the roof in Sky Dome and Cito Gaston decided that. I mean, it's amazing. It's really, truly amazing. By the way, there is a blue jay in our backyard that obviously has a nest somewhere close to us. It is a beautiful, beautiful bird that I have named Cito Gaston.
Nice.
And my wife was like, baseball? I was like, you got it. This is why it works.
I call mine Gary Carter.
Nice.
We have Blue Jays as well, yeah.
Both named after Toronto Blue. That's fantastic. Ray, have you named any animals after major leaguers that have come through your backyard recently?
No, I just usually unload the shotgun.
There it is.
We also have a baby possum that climbed up our back steps the other day and terrified my wife at the back door. I call him AJ Pierzynski.
So nobody likes him but you. No, I'm just
kidding. Exactly.
So, look, we have much more still ahead of us today. Yeah, please, Ray.
No, I was just going to say, not to be a pedant, but Gary Carter never played for the Blue Jays.
He met Joe
Wait,
Carter.
Wait, what? I met Joe Carter, sorry.
He met Joe
Wrong Carter.
Okay. Wrong Carter.
All good right. Lord.
Yeah, you confused me for a second, but
it's been a long day, Ray. I apologize.
I understand.
When we come on back, it was not a good game against the Miami Dolphins. I think we all know that. Kyle Shanahan tried to offer up some explanations. Jimmy Garoppolo offered up his evaluation of the day, and we're going to come on back and hear from both of them about what went wrong that afternoon. And I know an awful lot of people are laying so much of the blame of this game on Brian Allen's feet. And look, his feet failed him. But the coaching staff put him in a situation to fail. And then when he went out there and he failed, they put him back in a situation to fail again. This is something that Michael Irvin brought up. This is something that Eric Davis, when we talked to ED earlier today, brought up. You got to roll coverage. You got to help a guy who is not supposed to be on an island, but you're leaving out on an island. It's hard to get mad at the seventh guy on the depth chart. It's maybe a little easier to be bewildered by how Akello Witherspoon never lobbied harder to play earlier in the game, said, I'll be your emergency, was left in an emergency situation. And then when the game got away from the 49ers, you're sitting Garoppolo in the name of it's the smart, healthy choice, but you don't sit a corner whose hamstring could seize up, and that's what you're worried about. Like, there are things from the world of logic that still don't quite add up. We'll see if Kyle, who didn't really explain it all away yesterday, had some better answers today after he slept on it. But again, awesome stuff with John Miller. It was great to talk to him. And Joe Morgan, rest in peace, no doubt about it. When we come on back, much more 49ers, Dolphins, and a look around week 5 that is going to continue with a Monday night game and a Tuesday night game. Don't you go anywhere. Damon Ratto and Kolsky, and we're brought to you by Chilton Auto Body, which is open to serve the Bay Area with contact-free auto body repair options, along with free pickup and delivery. Chilton Auto Body now offers virtual estimates and curbside contact-free service from the comfort of your own vehicle. Book an appointment today at ChiltonAutoBody.com. Damon Ratto and Kolsky, 95.7 The Game. Welcome back, Damon Ratto and Kolsky here on 95.7 The Game. It is our final half hour of this very interesting and busy Monday, which launched our brand new lineup. Congratulations to all involved. An awful lot of work went into putting together our morning show, which I tuned into today. Kate sounded great. There was no doubt about that. Bonte and Joe were able to run fast enough to keep up with her. Midday was fantastic. And the three of us are as average to be expected. We've also got the football hour with Sean Salisbury coming up at 6 o'clock, followed by JD and Covey. So an awful, awful lot here on 95.7 The Game happening today. And obviously what happened yesterday with the San Francisco 49ers has got a lot of people scratching their heads around here. Matt, I was told that you have an Akilo Witherspoon analogy that maybe makes sense of the logic that we didn't really necessarily find yesterday from Kyle Shanahan.
Oh, I wish it made sense of the logic. No, I think it illustrates why I don't understand the logic, and it's a silly analogy, but hang with me here for a second, okay? Let's pretend we're dealing with just a like a small grease fire in our kitchen, all right? Sadly, we forgot to get a fire extinguisher, so that's not an option. You have two choices at your disposal. One of them is a large hose-like contraption that sprays a whole bunch of water. Unfortunately, it's not in the best condition, and there's like a 25% chance that you turn it on and it just dies. It just doesn't work. Your other option is one of those little spray bottle fans, you know, that like does a little spritz on your face on a hot day and blows a mist on you. Even if that little mister is fully functional, I'm trying the hose first. You know what I mean? And like, okay, maybe that's the last time I get to use my hose this year, but I at least want to try something that might put the fire out.
Well, if it's a grease fire, you don't want the water. You're going to want to smother that.
You're right.
You need some baking soda. But I totally get your analogy. Without it,
yeah.
Fire the big gun is basically what you're saying. Fire the big gun when you are in a battle. And Akilo Witherspoon, never billed as a big gun, was available more than, again, the pop gun that you get from the seventh guy on your depth chart in the practice squatter who got here today.
Yeah, it's just, it's until he explains this in a way that makes sense beginning to end, I think this is going to be one of those where we're going to find he's not going to be as forthcoming as we are used to him being.
Did anybody ask at the presser today?
I haven't seen a transcript, so I don't know.
And I've just been told we're having replay audio issues, so a whole bunch of sound that I was going to play, I can't play right now, unfortunately.
That is a problem. Do you guys know in the studio if he addressed that?
Wait a minute. We're back! I was told audio is now available. So one of the things that I wanted to really get into here was this cut from Kyle Shanahan, where he essentially explained that the reason why they kept on throwing the ball yesterday is because schedule went poof, just like that.
We had five sacks. I think three of them we had busts on protections. That's guys communicating at the line, playing faster, going through all the looks, and not making a mistake. I mean, those guys switch up fronts and their numbers all the time. When they do that, it puts a lot of pressure on an offense, and you got to be on it. And when you end up throwing the ball a lot more than you anticipate and a lot more than you ever want to, those things are what come up. So I thought we ran the ball very well. But when you only have 19 carries to show for it, you're going to be in some of those situations. Always when I do get in those situations, I start to worry about turnovers. I worry about the pressure that you're putting on the O-line, the pressure you're putting on the quarterback. And doesn't mean that always happened, but that was a situation that we got into, and that is what happened. We started making some mistakes in protection, made a few mistakes with the ball. I think we had six drops also. You know, 2 of 10 on third down, 0 for 2 on fourth down. Added with six drops, added with five sacks. I think we're throwing the ball too much. That's a situation that I got to try to control better, and hopefully we can play better as a team to where we make it easier for me to control that.
Niners were the best team on first down in the NFL last year. It has not quite gone that well, and that's why they're off schedule. And they don't have a team that can just go ahead and start attacking you downfield. They're not a chunk play team unless it's a catch and run or Mostert around the corner for 80 because the Jets weren't ready for kickoff. I mean, it is a – look, nothing takes you off schedule more than the Dolphins come right out, force you to go three and out, score again after another three and out, and then force you off the field with a stand on fourth and one when you're in field goal range. I mean, boom, it's 14-0 Miami, and you've squandered your first three possessions of the day. Now, what's crazy is that's not a death sentence. That's not when you stop running the ball, and I thought they stopped running the ball a little bit too early. And, oh, by the way, if you need important carries, his name is Raheem. That's it. Raheem Mostert needs more touches. You want to start running the ball more? Give the ball to your best running back more. I think that that's a good way for Kyle to start solving his running game problems.
Well, I think, yeah, he said that, he all but pilloried himself for doing the thing that he didn't really want to do, which was throw the ball, which tells me that he must have suspected that Garoppolo wasn't fully healthy, and B, that his offensive line probably wouldn't be able to protect him. So it sort of makes that, you know, that the weird McKinnon play at least mildly more understandable, although choosing to do that from a shotgun, you know, is still goofy, and choosing him other than Mostert seems goofy as well. But
or Wilson.
Or, well, you're right. Wilson, Juszczyk, pick your guy.
King Harvard.
I think the whole point is that what he said here was, I'm throwing the ball too much. And that's one of the very few times I've ever heard him second-guess his own play calling.
Yeah.
Which leads me to believe that he really does want to grind games down until either he fixes his offensive line problem, he gets Garoppolo healthy, or both.
He was then asked about a lack of urgency, which seemed to dot the entire afternoon. And I guess this is, maybe it's asking C.J. Beathard too much to go no huddle, but when it was time to play chop, 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 they were hardly out there chopping wood. It was still, let's take a huddle, let's bring the play clock down. Like, you let the Dolphins shorten the game. You don't do that. When it came time to let her rip, they still didn't necessarily let her rip. And if you say, well, there was no real option to let her rip, I'll agree that it was kind of a problem. Did Kyle Shanahan think that his team lacked in the urgency department?
No. I mean, people, when they get up to a mic and answer a ton of questions, I mean, after a loss, people are going to say whatever they can. I mean, you always want to work harder, do more. But my biggest thing is we got to do better. And whenever there's people on our team that I know, and they know the people that I'm not okay with their sense of urgency, and those are the people I address, and those are the people that have to deal with that. But as far as our team, I couldn't feel any farther from that. Our team works extremely hard. I see it every day, and that's why I believe our guys will respond. We just comes down to playing good, and we didn't play very well this week.
You know, I appreciate what you're trying to do there, Kyle, but guys sometimes aren't just given lip service. And for players, many of them, to agree that a lack of urgency was an issue, I think you should listen to your team. I didn't think that was media speak. I thought I saw a slow team, a slow football team, just a little hangdoggy on the way to the line of scrimmage. They were hardly dying to run that next play. They seemed timid. They blocked timid. That was not a day that was earmarked with a great effort. And even in defeat, I've seen the 49ers play ears pinned back, trying as hard as they can football. That really was not translated through my television screen yesterday, and I think a lot of people might agree with us here. We all thought that the biggest question of the day is what is going on with the start of Brian Allen over Akilah Witherspoon. Well, we wanted an explanation from Kyle Shanahan as to why that happened, and today he offered this up.
I mean, every guy's situation is different. Every injury is different, and every person you deal with is different. I know I was expecting him to go that week, and I think he was too. But it didn't look that way at all in practice, the way he was moving. And when I talked to him, the way he described it, how tight it felt, that's what he said. So, I mean, I never question guys what they tell me when you ask them, and they speak what is in their heart. So that's what he told me, and that's what I can go off of. That's why we had to make the tough decision to pick between Allen and Webster, and we ended up having to do that Thursday night. So that was the situation we're in. What I was happy with on Saturday, that him knowing our situation, at least he told me that he could dress and be used in case of an emergency, which I thought would only be after two injuries. And after we were struggling, though, I was glad he felt good enough to where we didn't have to wait for that emergency, and he told us he was good to go there in the second quarter.
Is that Jermaine with you guys? Does that work? Does that explain anything away? Not me neither.
For me, that's bad for a number of reasons. Here's the first reason. Was it ED who said he put it on Akello a bit? I thought that was harsh. But based on what Kyle Shanahan just said, I think it absolutely is on Akello Witherspoon. If you were going to come over 5 minutes into the game when someone's getting lit up and say, oh, I'm good to go now, why weren't you good to go at the start of a game where your team risked falling under 500 after a bad loss to Philly in a season where you expected to go to the Super Bowl? That's not enough of an emergency for you? But Brian Allen sucking for 5 or 10 minutes, that's the emergency all of a sudden? That doesn't sit well with me at all. And by the same token, if it really was that, I still don't understand why he's playing on the last snap of the game.
That, to me, is the far more troublesome thing. I could see where a guy, even if he's got a leg problem, sees that the guy who's playing out there is just getting rocketed and just says, oh, all right, if you need me, I can go. Okay, I can hear that. What I don't understand to this point, to this day, to this moment, is why, if he wasn't good enough to go until you felt, you know, compelled to play him instead of the guy who was getting rocketed, why does he stay in the game once the game is settled? You know, put Allen back in there. I mean, it's not like Brian Flores is going to just keep throwing the ball at his side to get to 57. He wants to chew up clock. He wants to go home. They all want to go home. So it's not like you're risking Allen's further psyche. You know, I mean, if that's the guy you chose and the game situation is now such that you don't need Witherspoon to play, then you make the change back. I'm not buying. I'm not buying him staying until the end of the game.
Look, Michael Irvin was laughing at the execution of the secondary, and I'm not kidding. Here he is.
Those DBs. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Wait a minute. They were attacking that secondary. This is not Aaron Rodgers. This is not Tom Brady. Not Drew Brees. Ryan Fitzpatrick, and he'll do that to people. He'll do it every now and then. That Fitzmagic stuff comes out, and I always worry about him because they were just throwing the ball deep. It's like, what do we have to lose here? You know, they were going deep, man. But those defensive backs, they were getting torched. They were getting torched by what I call, I don't know, a middle of the pack, certainly middle of the pack all passing game. They were getting torched. And you know, not having Bosa, you don't have Thomas, you understand what goes on up front. But, boy, on that back end with those young guys, they got torched pretty good.
Yeah, the burn unit was out there, no doubt. No doubt. It was bad. So, even though he tried to sprinkle it all around and just say rough day for the secondary. I thought Jimmy Ward was out there making plays. He was flashing an awful lot. I'll
tell you
what. I'll tip my cap to him just a little bit. Yeah.
I think people hopefully are waking up a little to how important K'Wan Williams is. I know, like, the idea of a slot corner is like, well, why isn't he on the outside if he's so good? But he locks down the slot every game he's out there. And boy, add that to the other, you know, the pile of other corner injuries, and I think that was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back in a lot of ways.
Yeah, this is one where you keep piling things up, and you keep making choices based on those pile-ups. You're going to make low-percentage choices, and that's what we're seeing more and more, Not, I think, because Kyle Shanahan has suddenly forgotten how to run a football game, but because his options are becoming more and more narrow. I mean, again, I go back to when he said, you know, I think we're throwing the ball too much. That's him trying to simplify the game so that the players that he's putting out there will not get overwhelmed as quickly as they did yesterday.
What about Saleh, though? Can we talk briefly about Saleh? Because, look, Shanahan's not going anywhere, and I think we all see what he does pretty regularly and successfully to be worthwhile, and we all know he'd be hired in a second. Robert Saleh, before last year, was on the hot seat. And last year, I think in retrospect, in large part because of a sudden influx of talent to that defense, Robert Saleh got a lot of love because his defense was one of the best in the league. And I'm not saying he didn't deserve that love. But at a certain point, and look, I'm also not saying he deserves all the blame because obviously injuries are part of this right now. But when you see things like not giving Brian Allen any help, despite him obviously being overmatched, it makes me think back to how in the first couple years of Robert Saleh, people were worried he was incapable of making adjustments.
Not blitzing enough. Yeah.
Yeah. And so when you don't have your full complement of talent, that's when the coach is supposed to become more valuable. And it seems like we have a pretty good track record of Robert Saleh being exactly as good as his players are all the time.
You know, sometimes Pro Football Focus is a wonderful tool, and sometimes there is proof that their numbers lie as well. Right now, Pro Football Focus, 2020 team grades say the 49ers have the 10th overall offense, they're 10th overall in football. So they have not fallen off as much as we and their record indicates. The 18th offense, tied for 18th, is what Pro Football Focus says, with the third best defense in football. Now, you can't help but immediately say, well, two of those games you are grading against the dumbest students in class. By the way, for the first time in NFL history, the Giants and Jets are a combined 0-10. They're both 0-5 on the year. So that is two of the best defensive days that this team has had. Otherwise, it hasn't been great. Special teams has been dreadful. 31st, says Pro Football Focus. But, yeah, sometimes numbers lie. You know, you look around Pro Football Focus grades, you see a lot of Niners offensive linemen scoring better in Pro Football Focus than the game you just watched with your own two eyes. So I don't know if that's just the timing of the bad plays, the carousel nature of some of the sacks that they have allowed, the turnstile, Trent Williams just lunging, basically stepping out of the way of a defensive end who busts him inside. You can say there was no help there that he was expecting. That was Laken Tomlinson's fault. Either way, the grades would indicate that the line is a lot better than what your own naked eyes told you. And just how uncomfortable either Garoppolo or Beathard or a week ago Mullins looked 2 weeks ago.
It does lead me to wonder exactly how good Pro Football Focus is.
Yeah,
I mean, it's supposed to be good.
It is.
I use it all the time, but it does make you wonder, okay, so what are the criteria we're grading on? Because if you only get 17 against an average defense like Miami's, after you don't get enough points against another average defense in Philadelphia, either you are grading on different criteria or points scored matters less than it should.
Yeah, maybe that's it. I don't know. They're more in love with efficiency than maybe touchdowns. And
well, here's what I don't understand totally is I'm looking at a graph right now that has the Niners in terms of offensive line win rate. It's plotted for pass blocking and run blocking. And they're in the bottom quadrant for both. So I suppose it's is there an exception along that line where some guys are playing better than we think, but one or two guys are ruining it for everybody maybe?
I can't really explain it other than no offensive line. All offensive lines are greater than the sum of their individual parts. And right now, individually, they might be scoring well or above average, but collectively, they're just not getting the job done, and they're not the earth movers that we saw run this team to the Super Bowl last year. And they're certainly not doing a glorious job of pass protecting the point where you have to pull your starting quarterback in the fear of further injury, which is always an embarrassing thing to do. Dante Whitner might have offered up yesterday the most biting, scathing commentary on what went wrong. He wanted to, and this is the second soundbite we'll get to, laying all the blame on Akilah Witherspoon, but not before he absolutely insulted the man as much as you can insult an NFL football player. Here is Dante Whitner on the 49ers official NBC Sports Bay Area postgame show.
Initially, it's on the player. If you know that you can get out there and compete and help your football team, why would you sit on the sideline and you know that this guy is overmatched? And this is why I've been saying the entire year, and I'm going to say it now. Akilah Witherspoon is soft. S-O-F-T. And you let the football team down by allowing this young guy to get out there. You guys fell behind by 3 scores, and there's no coming back. So it's on him and Robert Saleh.
And he went on to say, really, it is Witherspoon's fault. They lost the game.
If you're healthy enough to dress, you're healthy enough to play, right? And there's no excuses for this. I had a cornerback when I was in Cleveland, like my second to last year in the league, practice all week on the number one wide receiver, and we get to game day, he say, oh, I'm not healthy enough to play. So now you put us in a bind. We gave up 450 yards that day. This reminds me of that situation. If you're healthy enough to play and step on the football field on Sunday, you should be out there. You don't wait for this guy to get beat to say, hey, I'm ready to play. So I'm putting it on him and the defensive coordinator. This is why they lost this game in the way that they did.
Do we have the stuff? Biting criticism. We're almost done, Matt. Real final point.
Do we have the stuff he said about Saleh specifically as well? Because essentially what he said was, if you can't adjust when you lose talent, you're not a great defensive coordinator.
I'm not going to relitigate Robert Saleh's place on the team right here, but a few more games like that and people will be asking questions. And every team that's looking for a fall guy, it's not going to be Shanahan. It's not going to be Lynch. So Robert Saleh, your unit needs to be even better. No doubt about it. We know how banged up they are, but they just, Miami, with a quarterback they're looking to get rid of to replace with a rookie, just put up 436 yards to 259 yards by the Niners, and the day was embarrassing. We will have much more on it tomorrow, a Tuesday trifecta, a conversation with Peter King that's always an A-plus conversation. So make sure you come back for all of that. We're at the end of today's show. Let's just let you know that even though it feels like they're the underdog, the Tampa Bay Rays had the best record in the American League and are up 2-0 now on the Houston Astros in the ALCS. The Braves are underway with the Dodgers, and they're up 1-0 on the Dodgers. So we'll have more on baseball tomorrow, a little bit more on the Lakers title. We had so much football today. We forgot the other great stories, the Alex Smith resurgence, Seattle going to 5-0 and a huge comeback from behind fashion. Like, there is an awful lot of stuff from yesterday that we didn't get to today because this was not a Dolphin-free tuna broadcast. The Dolphins were all over this broadcast today. For Ray Ratto, for Matt Kolsky, for Eric Davis and Michael Irvin, who are fantastic today, we remind you to stay right here because the Football Hour with Sean Salisbury is next. Thank you very much for tuning in today. And remember, sports don't build character. They reveal it.
And like that, he's gone.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.